Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Jimmy Church, host of Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Coming up, more with Peter Lavenda. The book is called The Hitler Legacy, The Nazi Cult in Diaspora, How It Was Organized, How It Was Funded, and Why It Remains a Threat to Global Security in the Age of Terrorism. We have tied 1947, the origination of ufology, and Kenneth Arnold all the way through to the Apollo space program. How do we connect those dots? You do it on late night, overnight AM talk radio, right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. I'll be back more with Peter Lavenda right after this. Stay with us. Hi, welcome back to Coast AM. This is late night talk radio. We're going on a journey tonight with Peter Lavenda. Peter, are you still with us?
Sure am.
Okay, let's get into the new book and let's start to tie in all of this and come into the fourth quarter of this yarn. It is a crazy story, and it is spanning now, over 70 years?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, now the book is called The Hitler Legacy. It was released yesterday, and in the grand scheme of things, when we're starting to tie everything together, not only with Nazism, but its ties to global terrorism today, that is, you know, it's on the front of everybody right now, as far as our minds go, with ISIS, with Indonesia, Australia, Bali. It seems to be everywhere. And is the common thread the Nazi Party?
Well, yes, it is. I managed to speak with, to see up close and personal, the man in Indonesia who was responsible for the Bali bombing, the man who orchestrated it all. He was the co-founder of something called Jamaah Islamiyah, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Southeast Asia. And I listened to him talk about his rationale for the Bali bombings and for the other things that that his group was involved with. And it was straight out of the Nazi playbook. He was talking about a global, you know, worldwide Jewish conspiracy, et cetera, going on to this conspiracy of Jews and Freemasons and everything, which was straight out of what was, you know, current philosophy in the Nazi Party back in the 1920s and 1930s and, of course, during the war. And I'm looking at this guy in a country, in Indonesia. I was at his, what they call a pesantren, which is a kind of a boarding school, an mm-hmm. Islamic boarding school. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to this guy talk, and I'm thinking to myself, there are not 10 Jews in the entire country of Indonesia. You know, what are you talking about a global Jewish conspiracy for in a country that has no Jews? They only have enough Jews even for a minyan to have a service. There's one remaining synagogue, and it's empty. But it didn't matter. This guy was talking like he was in the 1930s in Germany. This philosophy, this ideology, permeated the thinking of these so-called jihadist groups all over the place. This is not an isolated thing. This is not something that comes naturally out of Islam, out of the religion, out of the culture. This is something that was adopted back in the 20th century. And it was adopted from first the Kaiser's Germany and then Nazi Germany. And this is something that they've adopted as part of an ideology, which is, quite frankly, a mixture of Western ideas mixed with local cultural idea concepts about their own religion. So what we're dealing with is that. We're dealing with this strange amalgamation of Nazi ideology and, in the beginning, Nazi money, Nazi financing, Nazi expertise. You asked me before, did we need the paperclip scientists? Well, we didn't. You know, we developed the atomic bomb on our own. We have the technology to do all of this on our own. But we didn't want the Russians to have the Nazi scientists, because then the Russians would get the jump on us, which they did anyway. We brought the Nazi scientists to the United States, thinking they would help us. Excuse me, but it was impossible. They were never going to help us, you know. We were naive. We thought it was like two kids fighting in a schoolyard. They beat each other up, and they shake hands, they're best of friends for the rest of their life. That's what we thought. We beat the Germans fair and square, you know, in the war. All is forgiven. Now you're on our side. Now you're working for us. That never happened. The Nazis did not give up. The cult did not suddenly go away. Christianity was under the gun for 300 years, 350 years. It was proscribed by every government on earth. And yet it survived in the catacombs, it survived in cemeteries, and then became a state religion 350 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, right? So why would the Nazi Party, which was a cult just like that, a well-financed cult with an observable ideology, why would it suddenly give up because they lost the war? They didn't. They just moved the theater of operations. They moved the war to the Middle East. They started building rockets for NASA. They moved it to America. They moved it to South America. They moved it to Asia, to Australia. They moved their theater of operations all around the world.
It is a case of, and you just touched upon it, but it is a case of they lost the battle being World War II, but they actually now, today, it seems like they have won or are winning the war.
Well, they got what they wanted.
Yes.
The Soviet Union fell. The United States is now under terrific attack from all sorts of places.
Exactly.
And what's the strongest country in Europe right now?
Germany.
Germany became reunified.
Mm-hmm.
Now practically runs the European Union. It's the most powerful country in Europe. Everything is going the way they wanted it.
What is the classic definition of Nazi cult?
Well, I don't know about a classic definition because I'm sort of the one who coined it. The Nazi cult itself is a combination of things. It's what do we call social Darwinism. We often underestimate the effect that Darwin's theories had, not just on science, but on religion. Darwin challenged religion tremendously by insisting that evolution had taken place over millions and millions of years. The idea of Darwinism was embraced not by religious people, but by cultists. It was embraced by the Theosophical Society, by Madame Blavatsky, who founded the Theosophical Society back in 1875 in New York City, coincidentally. This idea that mankind is perfectible, you can improve mankind, mankind is evolving towards a higher spiritual state, but in order to do that, we have to get rid of these elements that are holding us back. Sort of like animal husbandry, you know, we have to weed out those factors, those genetic components which are inferior, so we can more quickly become perfect. So this is the idea that Darwin believed in evolution having a gradual rate of change over millions of years, but the social Darwinists said, well, we don't have to wait. We're human beings. We know what's taking place. Let's tinker with this and make it happen. The Nazis were social Darwinists. They believed that we can physically intervene in evolution. And that's an old, old, ancient esoteric concept that people are progressing along a path of initiation to greater and greater levels of awareness. And this is part of what the Nazi cult is all about. It's anti-Christian. Of course, it's anti-Semitic. We all know that. It's a religious philosophy. It was designed to replace Christianity. If you were a member of the SS, for instance, you could not refer to Christmas and Easter in any official publication. Those holidays had ceased to exist. Baptism was out. There was a pagan ceremony that would replace it. There's photographs of that. There's photographs of Nazi wedding ceremonies, which are pagan ceremonies, essentially. The Nazi cult was designed to go back to a golden age when the only people in Germany were Germans. There was nothing else than screwing with the blood. And the Nazis understood this to be a religious thing, a spiritual matter, very much so. So much so that if a SS man slept with a Jewish woman, he was considered to be spiritually polluted. He would be kicked out of the SS because now his blood was no longer pure. His soul had been polluted in some way. These are the concepts that are behind the Nazi cult. And at the head of the Nazi cult is Hitler. Hitler was the Messiah, the occult Messiah, the avatar. In India, they saw him as an avatar. The swastika, the symbol of Nazism, is an ancient Asian symbol. And when Hitler used that symbol as a symbol of his party, the people in India, many of them nationalists, saw Hitler as being on their side, as being the representative of a Hindu deity, of an Indian god. I mean, this is what was going on. We had a guy in Chile called Miguel Serrano, who had been an ambassador of Chile to India, to Austria, to places around the world, to Yugoslavia. He was a friend of the Dalai Lama, and he was a person who said that, you know, Hitler was a great spiritual being. He held a funeral service for Nazis in Chile, the ones who had escaped to South America, who lived and died in Chile, including Walter Rauf, the man who invented the gas chambers, the mobile gas vans, lived out his days peacefully in Chile, and Miguel Serrano had the funeral service for this guy. This is what I mean about the cult. This is something which is totally alien in its sensitivity and its sensibilities to anything that we know.
Is there any, Peter? It seems like they've infiltrated or are involved with or mixed up in the major organizations here in the United States, terrorist organizations around the world, and it's one of our greatest fears, you know, the unseen thing, the thing that you can't control, and it's secret, and there's nothing you can do. Is there any borders? Is there any countries right now that are not affected?
Oh, you'd be hard-pressed to find one. People don't realize, for instance, that you know, there was a craze in this country in the 1960s and 70s over Japanese Zen Buddhism, as an example. Zen was everywhere. We had Alan Watts talking about Zen. Zen was the flavor of the week where spirituality was concerned.
That's right.
And, of course, the major figure in that was a guy called Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki. He was the sort of godfather of modern Zen studies. D.T. Suzuki was a Nazi. Now, I'm saying this to people, they're going to be shocked, and they're going to say, well, how do you say that? D.T. Suzuki, in his writings, showed a particular fondness for Germany, for the Nazi Party. He was an apologist for what the Japanese army was doing in China, slaughtering all the civilians. And he was a close friend of a guy called Durkheim. Durkheim was the head of the Gestapo in Japan during World War II. He was arrested by the Allies for a while. Durkheim then came back to the West and became another proponent of Zen Buddhism. You know, the connections are so bizarre, the deeper that you dig, that you find that this philosophy was so attractive to so many people all around the world, in South America, in Africa, in the Middle East. There's this worship of the Nazi Party. You can get copies of Mein Kampf translated into almost any language anywhere. I've been to a lot of countries doing this research, and I find local copies of Mein Kampf and of Henry Ford's book, The International Jew, translated into almost into languages you've probably never even heard of. And there's a cult aspect to this thing, and people are embracing it in different parts of the world. They're seeing that maybe Hitler had the right idea. You know, you hear that a lot of times, or Hitler was a genius. Hitler was, you know, way ahead of his time. You hear all of this around the world. It's a very frightening thing.
With Odessa and the way that it did, you know, just creep and creep and creep and eventually become global, how long did it take to get into Asia? And did it get into Asia around Japan? You know, not necessarily through Japan and the, you know, the Axis stuff that was going on in World War II. How did the infiltration happen throughout Asia?
Well, the very interesting story about that, as a matter of fact, something which I revealed probably for the first time in my book, Ratline, and I talk about it again in Hitler Legacy. There was a man who was a very close personal friend of Adolf Hitler. His name was Walter Havel. Walter Havel was a very young man during the Beer Hall Putsch. This was when Hitler tried to take over Germany in 1923, an attempt that had failed. Havel had marched with Hitler during the Beer Hall Putsch. He had marched with Himmler. He had been briefly arrested because of the failure of that attempted takeover. Havel then went to England for about a year or so, and then from England he went to Indonesia, what is now Indonesia, the Dutch East Indies at the time. He spent more than 10 years in Indonesia, and during that time he set up Nazi Party operations in all the major cities of Indonesia. So you had Nazi Party meetings in Jakarta, which was called Batavia in those days, in Surabaya, all over the place in Indonesia. There were Nazi Party operations. There was a Nazi Party in place. He came back to Germany when Hitler came back to power. When he became Chancellor of Germany, he called Havel back, and he became part of the Nazi Foreign Office. He was kind of an ambassador at large. He was one of the last people to leave the Berlin bunker in 1945, and no one knows what happened to Havel since then. The rumors are that he died somehow during the Russian takeover of Berlin, but his body's never been found. So Havel was a person who was instrumental in setting that up. And then in the 1950s, you had a guy called Hjalmar Schacht. Schacht was Hitler's finance minister. He went to Jakarta. He went to Indonesia to advise Sukarno, then the first president of Indonesia, advising him on how to create financial stability in his country based on the Nazi model, and was advising Sukarno to create an Islamic caliphate that would extend from about Malaysia and Thailand all the way through Indonesia and the Philippines to act as a buffer against Chinese communism. That was really the beginning of the terrorist movements in Southeast Asia. And, of course, we have the Islamic caliphate now in the Middle East. These were all ideas that were being promoted by the Nazis right after World War II had been over. They were trying to get, once again, the Muslims to be their foot soldiers in the fight against communism. And some of the most high-ranking and most visible names of the Nazi Party, of the survivors of the Nazi Party, were very much involved in doing this.
Why didn't we...
Heinrich Herrer in Tibet, you know, I mean, remember 7 years in Tibet, Heinrich Herrer, the guy played by Brad Pitt.
Absolutely.
Here was a guy who was a friend of the Dalai Lama, who was an SS officer and an officer in the SA, the stormtroopers, as we found out later, and who we now believe, because of documents that have recently come to light, as I talk about in the book, that Heinrich Herrer was also working for American intelligence at the time when he was there in Tibet with the Dalai Lama.
Why didn't we do anything to stop this? Is it because we constantly need to be in a state of war?
Well, we constantly need to be fighting communism, I guess, and we've made friends with everybody to do that. So we made friends with some of the worst people in the world. And as I say, we sold our soul. We did not have to do this. We are better than that. We're smarter than that. But we were frightened. We were frightened by the Soviet Union for reasons that are hard to understand at this remove. And we were doing everything possible to fight them, including making deals with Nazis and every other kind of extreme right-wing zealot that we could find. You know, and the church helped, not just the Catholic Church. The evangelicals helped. The Lutheran Church helped. The documentation is all there. You know, the Red Cross was involved. Everybody was involved in helping these people in promoting this underground network and making sure that it survived.
How close is it to being completely global right now, today? How close are we to that?
Well, you know, look around you. The philosophy of Nazism has not gone anywhere, has not disappeared. Nazism comes back, and it comes back without the stormtroopers. It comes back without the jackboots and the ridiculous helmets and all the rest of it.
That's
right. It comes back as guys dressed in business suits, okay? It comes back as politicians glad-handing you. It comes back in all different kinds of forms. The Nazis got very, very intelligent after the end of the war. They realized that you can't wear swastika armbands anymore and have anybody respect you. So they're doing it differently. They've morphed. They're morphing constantly, but the basic ideology is still there. It is an anti-materialist philosophy. They see communism and capitalism both as materialism, so they're against that. They're for a kind of weird spiritual extremism, you might say. And what they're trying to do with this is to create a new world order, you know, that term that's been used so many times, but it's got nothing to do with communism or socialism. It's got nothing to do with capitalism. This is something that's new, that's different. And they're using at this point, as my documents suggest, they're using the Islamic movements to help create the instability they need so they can come in and take better control.
When we come back, more with Peter Lavenda. This is, I'm serious, the reason to listen to AM radio over the night. This is why you learn, you get taken on a journey. Don't forget, we started in 1947. We started right there with Kenneth Arnold and Maury Island in the original ufology sightings, where flying saucer, that term was coined. And now we are dealing with global jihad, ISIS, global terrorism. It's all connected. I'll be back right after this. You are listening to Coast AM. More with Peter Lavenda. After the break, we're going to find out, what is the concern? What can we do about Nazism as a threat today? And also the influence in Islamic terrorism. I will be back after this. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. For those who know me, think that I picked all of this music tonight. No, that is all on Dan, and that is called Synchronicity. Had a great time. Amazing music tonight. Welcome back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Your host, Jimmy Church. I host a show called Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And I had said at the beginning of the show, George became a fan. He called in one night, and that was back in May. And here we are tonight, just going through the night together. Really appreciate it with guest Peter Lavenda. The book is called The Hitler Legacy, the Nazi cult in diaspora, how it was organized, how it was funded, and why it remains a threat to global security in the age of terrorism. It ties it all together. Little Green Men, UFOs, NASA, JPL, the Kennedy assassination, the Apollo program, and our issues with global terrorism today. We'll be back with more from Peter Lavenda right after this. Stay with us. All right. Welcome back, Coast to Coast AM. I have to thank Peter Lavenda for coming in and staying with us to the bitter end tonight. It's such an amazing story, and I thought it was so important. And it is what late night, overnight AM radio is all about, isn't it, Peter? Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now, the question is, now that we've painted this crazy story, this bleak picture, what can we do? What's the good news?
Well, one of the things that is actually a positive note in all of this is the growth of the internet. I mean, we do have access to alternate sources of information, and that's the first line of defense here. There's narratives that are being put out by all sorts of people with other agendas. If you want to pursue stories like this, if you want to find out what the truth is, you have to get beyond the ideology. The ideology will trip you up. Go where the evidence leads you, no matter where it leads you. It will lead you into some very strange places, and you're going to doubt what you're looking at. But if you can verify what you're looking at, if you can find other sources that support it, you'll get closer and closer to the truth. This is basically all we can do is on our own defend ourselves against the kind of groupthink that is being promoted these days. I mean, we're all victims of a sort of a cultural revolution that's taking place, which is not a particularly good one, where, you know, reality TV has done its number on us. A lot of internet sites are contributing to all of that as well. So we're being distracted from the real things that are going on around us by worrying about celebrities and that sort of thing. We're losing our focus on what's important. We're looking for distraction. We've had so many problems in the last 20 years or so that we're looking for, you know, diversion. And that's a dangerous thing. That's what the Romans used to do. They used to talk about bread and circus. And that's what we have these days, bread and circus. You know, we're basically living on fast food, and we're watching, you know, television programs that are basically concealing the truth from us, concealing the evidence from us, even if it's a news program. So what you have to do is just become a better consumer of information. That's the one thing that we all have to do. We have to look at what's happening around us and realize that our reality is being encroached upon. It's being created, manipulated behind the scenes. You know, what we think we know, we really don't know. And that's something that I've come across, the realization I've come to in my life. Ever since those days when I was 17 and 18 years old with this church that I really didn't understand and could only really understand years and years later when documents became available and I suddenly realized that I was looking at the names of people that I personally knew. I was in the middle of it and didn't realize that I wasn't paying enough attention, maybe. So this is what I mean. We all know we're all within 6 degrees of separation from any of these stories. You know, if we really think about it,
That's
know
right.
somebody who knows somebody who's connected to this. So be aware, be careful, open your eyes, look around you, see what's really going on, question things. Don't take whatever the official story is for granted, no matter who's giving you the official story. Always look behind a little bit. When people talk about things, when a story comes out and there's names, there's dates, there's places, remember what they are, write them down, because they'll come up again somewhere in another context, and that's when you'll start connecting dots.
Was it a part of one big plan, or was paperclip just a bunch of dominoes falling in a row and everything? But was it part of one big plan to get all of this done, and who orchestrated it? That's the puzzling thing. You're looking at the one, you know, the one person, the one leader that was pulling the strings on all of this, or was it just because we weren't looking?
Well, I think it's the latter. I don't think there's one person that you can point at. I think we weren't looking. We allowed these things to happen. There was a movement to make this happen. There was a lot of pro-Nazi, for instance, sentiment in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a lot of that. Charles Lindbergh, you know, most famously, Henry Ford. some of our greatest financiers and our greatest bankers and industrialists were pro-Nazi. You know, they believed in this ideology very much. They saw Hitler as a bulwark against communism and as a guy who would, you know, make, like Mussolini, make the trains run on time. There was a lot of this. It was already there. You know, the beginnings of Odessa were really back in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a mood in the country, a kind of an idea that, you know, we didn't like the immigrants, and we felt that the Jews were coming in too many droves, and they were taking jobs away from non-Jewish Americans. I mean, all the stories that we come across these days, we've already been there, done that in the 1920s and 30s. We called President Roosevelt a Jew who was trying to destroy the country and turn it into Israel or something. He was a communist. He was a dictator. All of this stuff was around in the 20s and 30s, just as they are around today. We have to pull back from all of that and realize that it's noise and it's not signal. And I look at sometimes history from a different perspective. I call it my quantum mechanical view of history. You know, is the Kennedy assassination a particle or a wave? It really depends on how you look at it, from what point of view. There's much more going on here than a bunch of guys in a back room smoking cigars and trying to manipulate the world.
Sure.
It's deeper than that. It's much deeper than that. There's the deep state, as Peter Dale Scott calls it and other people call it. There's the deep state, and there's something even deeper beyond that. There's a kind of a ghost in the machine that's making all of this happen as well. And I think we need to be sensitive to that, too.
Well, you say... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we need to be aware of the spiritual component to all of this without sounding too hokey. There is a spiritual dimension to what we're talking about. There is something deeper. And if we can't grasp it intellectually, maybe we can grasp it on an intuitive level, on an emotional or spiritual level, and we may be able to fight it that way.
Well, when you say, you know, most of it is behind the scenes, you know, you don't see it. It is completely veiled. Is there a country where it is completely out in the open and they just don't care?
Wow. I'd have to really think back. I mean, you know, Nazi Germany was the place where it was out in the open.
I mean, today, right now, I can get on a plane and just go and feel very uncomfortable. Where would that be?
That's a good question.
Or is it you?
I don't know.
You just don't want to say it. I can understand. It's okay. Hey, you know, Peter, I say it all the time about you. I've said it to you. I've said it about you. But you must sleep with one eye open. You have to. You research and report and write about probably the most sensitive taboo subject out there. And, you know, the SS and Nazis and them taking over and infiltrating our own cherished programs over here, our moon program, Apollo, our rocket program, and it continues to this day and around the world, and you have to deal with it. You must sleep with one eye open. Tonight you will, after this program.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I will. I'm calling from an undisclosed location, you know.
Exactly. We know that, by the way.
Right.
But what is the country? I'm going to say it one more time. There's some place right now where it is just out in the open. Would that be in South America?
Well, you know, there has been. There's been a lot of tumult down there. I mean, if you had asked me a couple of years ago, I would have said Chile. It's out in the open. Argentina was out in the open. Paraguay was out in the open. Brazil's going back in that direction. Sure, there's countries that are, you know, embracing this sort of thing. Of course, there's a lot going on in the Middle East, as we all know. Russia is now going back in that direction. You know, it's going in a kind of a fascist direction. There was always this fascist tendency there. Anyway, Putin is not really a communist wannabe. I mean, he was head of KGB, but I think he's more of a fascist than anything else. There's all sorts of, you know, you can draw all sorts of parallels, and probably you don't have to go very far to see stuff that's happening around you today in this country. You know, if you keep your eyes open, you'll see a lot of, you know, deliberate manipulation of the news, deliberate manipulation of the story, of the narrative, the spin that goes on to any kind of an event. You have to pay very close attention. You have to draw your own conclusions and not be led, you know, by emotion. Try to understand the data as you get it, you know, analyze it carefully. It's all I can say. The power structures that we're talking about shift with time. They'll move from one place to another, from one country to the next, until everything is going the way they want it to. But right now you have a problem with what we call terrorism. It's largely an illusion in some cases. You know, we've created the war on terror, like we have the war on poverty and the war on drugs and everything else. We have to understand it's not religion that we're fighting out there. We're fighting political politics. We're fighting power politics. The people that we're fighting in the Middle East really are not fighting because of religion. But that's the narrative we're given. We're given this narrative that, oh, this is a religious war. Well, it isn't. It's a war about tribes. It's a war about tribal power, about trying to get the upper hand in various regions. It's not about anything else. But we've cast it into this religious thing, and we're not going to get out of it. And until we can get past that, we're never going to be able to handle it. The whole Nazi influence on this thing has been so deep and so perfectly orchestrated that we're actually believing what they want us to believe.
Are you aware of the reports that started to surface this week once again that Hitler died in 1995 and was very aged? Have you seen these reports?
Yes, I have.
And where do you stand on that? Did he get out? Did he make it to South America?
Well, the data that has come out, I covered this in Ratline kind of extensively. What has been reported about his death and the forensic evidence is all bogus. It is completely bogus. It is so badly done that you wouldn't even make a good TV program out of, you know, of a CSI program on this, because there was no forensics on Hitler's body. There really wasn't. The whole thing about the dentures or the teeth and everything else is totally wrong. Everything has been exploded, I think, successfully in the past few years. There is no forensic evidence that Hitler died in the bunker. There's no forensic evidence that Eva Braun died at all. There's nothing there. The bodies that they had were not the bodies of Hitler. The skull that the Russians claim is Hitler's skull is not Hitler's skull. It's not even the skull of a man. It's the skull of a woman. So there's, you know, we have no proof that he ever died in the bunker. There's no proof at all. And I followed a story for a long time. I still follow it in Indonesia, that, you know, a strange couple that wound up in a remote island in Indonesia. The local people were convinced that was Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence where it could have happened that way. If I was Adolf Hitler, I would not have wanted to go to South America, because I couldn't trust the people who had tried to betray me so many times, who had tried to assassinate me, you know, during Operation Valkyrie and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Why would Hitler hang out with other Nazis who would drop a dime on him for their own benefit?
Well, what about the evidence?
Escape somewhere else.
Right. But what about the evidence about him, living quite long in Argentina and Chile, and Eva Braun as well? What about that evidence?
Well, it's based on eyewitness testimony at this point. There's not a lot of other evidence that I've seen, but it's entirely possible. I mean, I covered a story where I believe that he had left, if he had left, he left through northern Italy, possibly went to Argentina, but I don't think he stayed there. I don't think he remained in South America. I think that if he had escaped, he would have gone to Asia, where nobody would have been after him. Remember, the Israelis snatched Eichmann out of Argentina in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
They would definitely have gone after Hitler had they known he was there. So I think going to a country that was, you know, as on the other side of the world, like Indonesia, a Muslim country, where any white person would be visible for miles, I think that he chose the right place to hide. If in fact he chose Indonesia, it would make excellent sense to me. I don't think he would have wanted to stay in South America very long. I think he would have been afraid of people turning him in, or an Israeli commando squad, if nothing else.
Right. Well, what evidence do you have that supports Indonesia besides the couple and eyewitness testimony that you just referenced?
A lot of documents that I was able to see while I was in Indonesia and in Singapore last year. There's a lot of documentation that's there. I was able to take a look at parts of a notebook that was allegedly kept by this person who we claim is Hitler, some other circumstantial evidence of his escape into Indonesia, including the fact that his wife was a kind of a dead ringer for Eva Braun, and went back to Europe at the time when Eva Braun's father was getting sick and dying, and she disappeared from Indonesia and wound up in Europe. There's a lot of stuff that I cover in Ratline which seems to suggest that it's a very good possibility that, you know, Hitler might have wound up there. But it's not proven. The jury is still out, absolutely.
It's an insane story. What are you doing now? Are you going to be doing any speaking?
Probably, yeah, I'm looking towards that. I'll be doing some more interviews in the next couple of weeks as well. People will be able to find that on the internet, I'm sure. I'll be talking about this story for a while. The whole terrorism angle, the whole Islamic thing had never occurred to me before, but when I came across all of this information, it made me realize that we were onto something, you know, much bigger than just the Nazi story itself, but it's something that's relevant today. So that's what I'm really fascinated by.
I have to ask you, has anybody approached you about, a movie, a screenplay? Because certainly, and I know you and I have talked about this, but it's the craziest script that you could possibly write. You know, you can hire the best screenwriter in Hollywood, and it just wouldn't be this good. Is there any talk about that at all?
There has been. I don't go into details, but there has been. People have talked about using Ratline for that purpose. There's a story in Ratline for sure. And now with the Hitler legacy, there's more discussion. I just talked to someone the other day, yesterday, about the possibilities of Hitler legacy and some kind of a script based on that concept. So, you know, there's some stuff going around. There's some people talking about it for sure.
And what are the websites? Let's get that out of the way before we say goodnight, sir.
Yes, well, you can find me on peterlavenda.com, which is a brand new website that I just got up yesterday, I think. And there's also a website for the book, The Hitler Legacy, and one for Ratline. There's a video on the Ratline.us of me at the cemetery where the Hitler figure is supposedly buried in Indonesia. So it's a kind of a spooky little video which shows me talking over the grave of the man they claim is Hitler. And there's a lot of very strange circumstantial evidence surrounding that grave. For instance, the fact that the birth date and death dates did not appear. He was buried kind of anonymously. So there's all sorts of wild stuff going on with this story, and it gets wilder every day.
We almost neglected that, and I'm glad you brought it up. We're in the last minute. Explain the date on the gravestone. We should have spent some time on this, but we've got like 1 minute left. It is so important.
Well, the man that we're talking about was a German doctor, evidently, or an Austrian doctor. Austrian, like Hitler, was Austrian. Claimed to be a doctor. Didn't really seem to operate as a doctor. Died mysteriously in the city of Surabaya in Indonesia, buried in this grave. Now, every tombstone in Indonesia has the day someone was born and the day they died. Well, this tombstone had neither. They had the name of the guy, but no dates on it. It's extremely mysterious. And at some point, somebody later on with a magic marker put in the day of death, but the date of birth is still missing. That means they really don't know who's in that tomb. It's like that old joke, who's buried in Grant's tomb. We don't know who's buried in that tomb. What we know is from circumstantial evidence that the guy who was buried there, if it is the same guy, was the same height and generally the same appearance and roughly the same age as Hitler.
You can't sneak in at night, you know, with a shovel, grab some DNA evidence.
Oh, believe me, I thought about that so many times.
I know you have.
It's not possible. I thought about it, believe me.
Peter Lavenda, what a great night. Thank you so much for this. And again, for everybody out there that was listening, I know that we just took them on an insane journey. They're going to start investigating tomorrow. They're going to jump on the net. They're going to listen to this show again. They're going to check out the names, the dates. They're going to find out that everything works and is true in this story. It's an amazing tale. Thank you for all of the work.
My pleasure.
All the best. Peter Lavenda, everybody. Thank you, Peter. Coast to Coast AM. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, George. Thank you, everybody here, the team. I had a great time. Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Dan. Tomorrow, with George. George has on Howard Wasdin, training Navy SEALs, and also our good friend, Tracy Twyman, will be on with George tomorrow. Ouija boards. Tracy is the best. I'd like to thank everybody here at Coast to Coast AM. I am Jimmy Church. Follow me on Twitter at J Church Radio. You can email jimmychurch@coasttocoastam. I am the host of Fade to Black on the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'll see you this week. Behave.